ora, and welcome to System Fix, the podcast for health reform junkies from the health media. My name is Barbara Fountain, and I am editor of New Zealand Doctor Rata Aotearoa. Each episode of System Fix, we take a look at progress with the reforms proposed for the New Zealand health system. Those arose from the report of the New Zealand Health and Disability System Review Panel, aka the Simpson Report. The recommendations of that panel were significantly revved up by the Health Minister at the time, Andrew Little, to become what I like to call the Big Little Revolution. On System Fix, I speak with regular panellists and invited guests about the changes, the highs, the lows, what's happened to date, and what we might expect. Thanks for listening. Kia ora, and welcome to episode 24 of System Fix. Today I'm chatting to Te Whatu Ora National Director Commissioning Abby Anderson via Zoom about progress on localities and the restructuring of her team. We'll also look at the prospects for change to the primary care funding model and the budget for the sector. But first, an update on where we are at. It's been stop-start progress for the proposed charter, a document aiming to underpin a new culture within the sector. Initial work on the charter was shelved last year, but former ICU specialist David Geller is back on board leading the latest work. The charter is the last of three general documents mandated in the Paiora legislation. The other two were the Government Policy Statement on Health and Te Pai Tata, the Health Plan. Localities are getting a lot of airtime as Dr. Anderson travels the country visiting the prototypes and taking stock of draft plans. It has not been without controversy. The largest prototype, Otara Papatoetoe, presented an 80-page draft plan, but found it wasn't quite what was being called for. We're still awaiting the appointment of a new board chair for Te Whatu Ora, following the sacking of Rob Campbell. You can hear more about that in episode 23. Now I've mentioned it, you can probably expect an announcement before I finish editing this episode. Progress has been slowed on the rapid restructuring timeframe for Te Whatu Ora, giving staff, management and unions more time to work through the necessary processes. Dubbed Simplify to Unify, potentially up to 1,600 roles are affected, ranging from name changes and new reporting lines to axing completely. The first four areas being worked on are finance, commissioning, the National Public Health Service and service improvement and innovation. And next month sees the one-year anniversary of the new agencies, Te Whatu Ora, Te Aka Whai Ora, the National Public Health Service, and the Public Health Agency. Time will tell whether it will be a cause for celebration. Kia ora, Abby Anderson, and welcome to System Fix. I should tell our listeners this is the 8:30 slot on a Monday morning in Abby's chocker diary. Hopefully the coffee has kicked in for both of us. Abby, when I first got in touch a few months back, I was thinking of a primer on commissioning, but things are moving quite fast in your space now. The internal restructuring at Te Whatu Ora, the rejection of the 5% capitation uplift, and plenty of activity on the locality front. You've been on the road quite a bit lately. How are people feeling in the primary care and community health sector with regard to reform?
Kia ora, and thank you so much for the opportunity to be involved in this. Yes, I've been traveling quite a lot around the country, and I would have to say the prevailing attitude that I come across is one of hope, one of expectation. And in fact, one of the things that I lay awake a bit at night thinking about is how we make sure that we set realistic expectations for what we're really going to be able to achieve. It's an exciting time to be part of this, but there's also so much history of not funding enough in primary care, for example, and not having enough workforce being trained, that those chickens have come home to roost, it feels, post-COVID, or not post, we're still in COVID, but that's a real challenge for all of us to try to tackle. If there's anything that keeps me awake at night, it's workforce, and how are we going to meet the rightful expectations that not just our providers have, but in particular communities and whānau with the really tired and stretched workforce that we have. My favorite part of the travels at the moment are going out to localities, and I know that's one of the things you'd like to talk more about. And, you know, for me, localities is such a key plank of these reforms. I get energized and recharged. I haven't actually gotten tired from all these travels yet. Well, maybe I have. Maybe that's why I've been a bit unwell this last week. But those travels and meeting the people who are at the heart of this, you know, communities and whānau, and hearing their expectations and their hopes, and seeing that they are willing to extend that hope yet again.
When we talk about workforce, we're often kind of referring to the frontline workforce, but it's also an issue for the back room, the management, and certainly for Te Whatu Ora at the moment, and you're going through significant restructuring. How is that progress in your area with your team?
Not fast enough. I think we're all really eager to just get to the end of it. You know, one of my team members the other day on Zoom meeting, I think very delicately put it to say, look, this started off really rough. And it did. There were process errors that occurred that really wish hadn't occurred. But, you know, that was in things like not getting letters to the right people in a timely manner, that sort of thing. But we have hopefully gotten through that. And we have been doing our level best to really get out and respect and honor our team with as much information as we can possibly give about what that new team structure is meant to look like. And the thing is, people are really holding on to that vision too. I'm really impressed by the professionality of our team and by the fact that they really do see the vision that we're all working toward, and they want to achieve that. They want to be part of that. Prevailing attitude, I think, is tired and just want to get on with it now.
So that actually might be a good time just to mention what exactly is commissioning and how much will that change the way that your team members have previously worked in their former DHB roles?
You know, if you think about the former DHBs, that, you know, there were 20 self-contained groupings doing the full commissioning, all the decision-making locally. It might help if I step back and describe what I actually mean by commissioning. And you'll notice, Barbara, that I don't use the title National Commissioner. I never refer to myself or my team as commissioners for two reasons. One is the power thing, right? Titles like that confer power. And we're trying to put the power in the hands of communities and whānau, not in the hands of public servants and bureaucrats. And the second thing is that commissioning is not a person. It's a process. It's a cycle. And I usually describe it as a four-step cycle. And the first step of that is designing systems of care. And the second is agreeing health and well-being plans. The third is executing those plans. And last is monitoring outcomes, which feeds back into the start of the process. Even more important is what sits at the center of that model, and that's people. And that's communities and whānau. You know, we want a community and whānau-led system where we listen to people and design the system based on communities' priorities. And the localities model is a key structure in enabling that to happen. But also, in addition to communities and whānau, at the center of that commissioning model is providers of care and our partner networks. You know, the majority of care is provided outside of hospital in the community and in people's homes, including in aged care. And that's not just by professionals, but by carers and, you know, family members. And these are our critical partners in the delivery of care. And, you know, and speaking of partners, we've got those existing networks that we work with, like PHOs, as well as industry peak bodies and NGOs. And we have this new landscape of iwi Māori partnership boards. And of course, the emerging structures that support localities, like, you know, locality partnership groups and networks of local providers.
For your new commissioning teams, is there a significant change in the culture of how they work under a commissioning paradigm as opposed to a former contracting paradigm? And is that something they would need to be actively trained in?
I guess one of the key differences is we won't have 20 replications of the same self-contained units, right? So the national roles, and when I talk about national roles, I don't mean people living in Wellington. You don't live centrally in Wellington or Auckland to do a national role. You can and should be anywhere across the motu, because in fact, I want that diversity and that spread in our thinking. But national roles are all about achieving consistency in the system. They're about doing the system design. So in fact, that's that first step in that four-step model that I described a moment ago, was designing the systems of care. That's actually probably my favorite and the most fun part of the commissioning cycle. And we intend, rather than us making decisions about what the system design should be under this new model, we want to engage really broadly with a broad group of stakeholders to lead that design work. So we will soon be asking to get sector experts, people with lived experience, you know, diverse voices coming and working with us on a part-time basis, you know, in temporary groups. We're calling them the strategic design networks. So Te Paitata talks about standing up some strategic networks. And I've, as I say, called them strategic design networks because I want those sector experts to be supplementing our teams. And we would be facilitating that work of designing the systems of care. By systems, I'm talking about, you know, general practice and the future of general practice funding. I'm talking about aged care, you know, residential and home and community support services. I'm talking about maternity. I'm talking about oral health, you know, community labs. There's so many different parts of the system, as I referenced earlier, have, I think, reached that tipping point where We really need to sit down and talk about what do we as a society want and what can we afford and what is sustainable in terms of what we can actually deliver. So our teams are going to be structured around the national functions being about facilitating those conversations led by the sector and by communities, not led by us making the decisions. And that is actually a key difference to how we have functioned previously, because we have not had that ability to plan a single system. We've planned in 20 different chunks. I'm pleased to say, and I can't speak on behalf of my ministry colleagues, but Manitou Haora has talked about working closely with us in that, so that that design work helps to inform their strategies and the long-term blueprints for healthcare in the country. So that's the national teams. To the other end, we've got the local teams. Those will be the people that are supporting localities. And out of all of our teams, they're the only people who we will require to live in those localities. So they really know those communities and have that ability to have the trusting relationships because they're part of the community, right? And then in the middle of that are the regional teams. And they're actually the biggest teams within commissioning. And you'd probably be aware that Te Whatu Ora is restructuring itself into those four regions of Northern, Te Manawataki, Central, and Te Waipounamu. And that's all of our different groups, whether it's hospital and specialist services or National Public Health Services. We're all structuring ourselves in that way. Regional groupings have what are called regional integration teams. And those regional integration teams are co-chaired by Te Aka Whaiora's regional directors and by my commissioning regional team members that I've called the regional wayfinders. In each place, the two people that are co-chairing are responsible for making sure that we bring together the hospital and specialist services, National Public Health Service, et cetera, and come together to plan how the national conversations, how those are going to feed into and support what localities are saying they want and how we're going to reflect locality priorities in our regional plans.
We'll come on to localities, and I think it's fair to say there still remains quite a bit of confusion around localities. A locality is a geographical space, needs to be finalised by July 2024. The recent news, like from Otara Papatoetoe locality, where we saw an 80-page plan delivered to Te Whatu Ora, is this locality moving too fast for Te Whatu Ora? Didn't seem like everything went quite as the members of the locality network were expecting.
Yeah, and I think that expectation word is the key one there, Barbara, and that's what I raised earlier. One of the things that I said that keeps me awake at night is making sure that we are being clear in expectations. And that's a two-way street as well. This isn't about us dictating everything, but at the same time, with localities in particular, it's at such an early stage. And those 12 prototypes are really all about testing out what works and walking alongside them and really learning from that to try to feed into the next processes. And so we're still working very closely with all of our 12 prototypes. Learning as we go along. And I think there was an emerging mismatch in expectations that we've sat down around the table, and I think we've come, you know, back to where we need to be. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of to be expected in something as new and as different as localities. And as undefined, I've been a little bit surprised when I've come on board since September of last year, read a lot of cabinet papers, Barbara, and read a lot of other materials and, you know, talked to some of the people that were the original architects. And I think, you know, that what has happened, and I've said this many times, but what attracted me to come back here to New Zealand is that, A, I love New Zealand, but also I'm so impressed by these reforms and by how much ground has been made so far. And I know about place-based planning initiatives, which is what localities really at its heart is. And I think it's brilliant. But applying it to a whole country is a huge reform in its own right. And we're trying to do that at the same time that we're reforming so much else, including our very own, you know, organizational structure. So I've said many times, it's no surprise that these reforms are still as messy as they are. And we should expect them to be at this size and this, you know, magnitude and moving at this rate and this early on in the reform piece.
So we did have a similar issue at the beginning of the primary healthcare strategy when PHOs were implemented, and that there was a certain amount of permissiveness around what
exactly,
you know, constituted it. And at the time, as you would expect, people ran with it because it represented a new source of funding. And here, the same with localities, people have been waiting for quite a long time to look at having more community-led services, better ways of doing them, achieving equity in health outcomes. And so you can understand why the enthusiasm is there.
Absolutely. And we certainly don't want to quash enthusiasm. And I, you know, said at that particular meeting, I feel terrible because I'm sitting here listening to what, you know, you where you want to go and how quickly. And I said very bluntly, I feel I'm going to disappoint you really badly right now because I don't have the resources to be able to contribute to that right now.
We talk about the prototypes as a learning process. How do we actually share the good and the bad in terms of the learnings, the lessons that come out of that?
I'm so pleased to hear you say that. I hate the word learnings too. It's like, when did we come up with that word? They're lessons, aren't they?
Yes, they are lessons. Absolutely.
So we've actually been doing evaluation program alongside. So we've had an independent organization coming alongside and, you know, interviewing all the participants and capturing those lessons. And we've stood up and are in the process of standing up more of a website that has like a shared learning environment. So the prototypes have been using that, and we want to make that available, obviously, to the next lot of localities too. So at the moment, you know, localities are about supporting a collective local voice, you know, to influence health service planning with the intent of improving well-being for everybody in that locality. And for me, it's about replacing unwanted variation, that's, you know, the disparities in health outcomes, with wanted variation, which would be like variation in service delivery that fills gaps and leads to greater consistency in the health outcomes. So no matter who you are or where you live. We're on track to meet the legislated deadlines that you mentioned a moment ago. So establishing locality boundaries by July 2024. We currently have recommendations from Iwi Māori Partnership Boards for a further 22 locality boundaries, so 34. And that would cover, as I said, about 57% of the New Zealand population. And those recommended boundaries, they're being worked up with local government as well. And then they would come to the boards of Te Whatu Ora and Te Aka Whai Ora and the minister. That should happen within the next month for provisional endorsement to then be made available for public consultation. So by July 2024, we expect to have completed that process for every part of the country. The July 2025 date that you were referring to, Barbara, we've got until then to have the localities producing locality plans. So we've got a bit of time, although not a huge amount, to, you know, do the other things that need to be done, like getting the establishment of the locality partnership groups and the networks of providers, you know, that were envisioned by the architects of the reforms.
Can we go back to that total number? I mean, you might recall that with the PHOs at one stage, we got up to 82.
Yep.
And then they were knocked right back to around 30. And there were reasons for that around economies of scale and actually also capacity within the system. We seem to be going back in the other direction of having a larger number again. Is that wise?
Yeah. Well, that's a really good question, Barbara. We're having a lot of debates about that. And I think we have to remember localities are doing a different thing to what you would want or expect a PHO to do. And I don't envision a time because A, the country wouldn't be able to afford it, and it wouldn't be wise, in my opinion, to have localities trying to be infrastructures that do all that a PHO does or that try to replicate things that Te Whatu Ora can do, etc. So we are right at the point now of having conversations now that IMPBs are actual things, because of course they weren't even in existence when the 12 prototypes were brought into place. So now that those are coming into being, you know, sitting down with them as well as the early prototype locality partnership groups. So under the legislation, IMPBs are meant to be engaging in, you know, they're part of that community voice and doing community engagement to gain that community voice, which is very much what we've also, you know, been funding the locality partnership groups to do on our behalf. So under the legislation, it's Te Whatu Ora's responsibility to engage with communities. But we've, in effect, at this moment, we're outsourcing that to those 12 prototypes in those regions. And I'm really comfortable with, and in fact, I think they are absolutely better at gaining that community voice than we are directly. So I think that's a really good model. And I think that we can afford to continue to have them doing that on our behalf. But we also need to make sure that IMPBs aren't expecting to do the same thing with the same people, because communities don't want to be asked over and over again the same sort of questions. So we need to walk that ground and work that through to see how is that going to work and come to agreement around that. But one of the things that I don't see us doing, and I've been really clear about this with the localities, and thus far, the vast majority of the localities have completely agreed with me. And that is, we don't need localities to be actually doing the commissioning. They don't need to hold the funds and purchase the services, because you do need to build up an infrastructure in order to do that. We've got that infrastructure within Te Whatu Ora. And my vision for our team is that we are serving the people. So we will act at the direction of those localities with the priorities and the plans that they've done. So that's how I see it happening, in a way that is more efficient and doesn't get get into that problem of not being able to support the number of localities that we need. Because one last point on that, Barbara, is that in conversations that our boards are having right now about this very topic, one of the most important things for localities is that local people actually feel connection to them. And if they're too large, local people don't feel that connection. And so we are walking that tightrope balance right now to try to figure out how many is enough and how many would be too many and what can we actually afford going forward. It's a very active conversation right now.
So maybe part of the problem that you've seen with Ōtara Papatoetoe, and I'm not speaking on their behalf, is an issue of trust that communities, and particularly communities of Māori and Pacifica providers, haven't necessarily trusted the former health officials to do this work on their behalf. And that's why they're running with it as fast as they can.
Barbara, you're totally right. And I get that. I can understand that. Absolutely. Proof will be in the pudding. And we're asking people to hope. And I'll tell you, one of my favorite moments so far in my role was sitting in this very room that I'm in right now over the Waitangi Day weekend this year. I read the very first of the locality draft plans that I had received. And that was from our furthest northern locality. Taikorehi is the name. And I didn't even get past page two before I just sat here and started to cry, because the very name, which was gifted to that locality of Taikorehi, references the turning of the tide when it's reached its lowest ebb. And I just read that and I went, wow, this is people who have been through a lot, haven't they? people who are willing to trust again. They're willing to hope again. They're saying, okay, we're going to give this another shot. And I feel the weight of that on my shoulders to make sure that I do my level best to do my part to contribute to making sure that we actually honor that. Mm-hmm. And that's what's really sitting at the heart of these reforms and the heart of, you know, what we're all trying to do. And that's what I see my team members holding on to, even in the midst of all of the uncertainty in the reform that we're going through. And that's what I see people in localities, whether we're having difficult conversations or really positive ones, everybody's hanging on to that same vision. And that's what's keeping everyone going.
With iwi Māori partnership boards, what level of resource are they receiving to enable them to be effective in the role that's spelt out for them in the legislation?
Most of the resource that they're receiving is actually through Te Aka Whai Ora, so I don't have complete visibility of that. Through my team, we have some Budget 21 money that we've made available to them as well, but it's a small amount, so I'm not going to put words in their mouths, but I would not be surprised if they say they're not receiving enough.
Because we realise that all iwi are being called on to provide advice and partnership in a whole pile of areas outside of health. You'll obviously be aware of the ongoing issues around primary care funding. And it's quite difficult, I think, to kind of even think about commissioning community services when the level of funding and how it's distributed isn't that clear. I saw the General Practice Leaders Forum wrote to you when they rejected the offer of the 5% capitation. And I have to admit, I was not that clear on the extent of the role of the National Director Commissioning. Does the buck stop with you with regard to capitation funding?
Yes, it does. So briefly, I guess, if you think about what Te Whatu Ora does, we provide directly hospital services. That's not my shop. The direct provision of hospital and specialist services isn't part of commissioning. The commissioning team, essentially, we manage the $8 billion of everything outside of hospital. So road and air ambulance, there's $1.5 billion we fund in primary care, another $1.5 billion in residential aged care, home and community support services, oral health, community pharmacy, community laboratory, maternity, community radiology, and mental health and addictions, I think. Plus in that $8 billion, there's about $1 billion of that's previous vote health, various, programs around targeting specific communities like, youth or rural or rainbow health, those sorts of things. So that's all of the funded sector. All of those contracts come through my area.
So back last year when our reporter Martin Johnson talked to you, you identified the problem that has long existed in the health system. Quote, "We've had a system whereby the costs of the hospital have been sucking money back in and detracting from the ability to fund things in the community," end of quote. So as you just mentioned, primary care funding is separated from hospital funding. And I just wonder how you will prevent cost shifting, for instance, people being discharged from hospital even earlier when we have new community facilities to provide support. When the two funding streams are separate, how do you deal with that problem?
Yeah, carefully. So, the good news, and as I talked to Martin about back then, is that those appropriations are now separate in the sense that no longer can money that's been set aside for the funded sector can't be held onto and at the end of the year, put back into cover hospital deficits. We can't do that anymore. So that's a really good thing, firstly. But then to your question about, well, how do we prevent that from happening in a different way through, change of the way we deliver services? And that's going to have to be through, constant monitoring. And through that system design work that I talked about before, that's one of the exciting parts, I think, about what we want to do in looking at how we design systems from end to end. So when I talk about even just looking at general practice funding, that's a really big conversation. It's not just about funding. It's not just about capitation. It's about the lot and about what we can be doing in general practice and with what workforces and how we actually look to, the future of general practice, not just what it looked like in the past. Mm-hmm. And always remembering that one of the big, changes that we're trying to affect is the change in outcomes around equity. So we need to make sure that if we are having a system that looks similar to what it used to look like, it needs to perform a bit differently though. Do you know what I mean? It needs to achieve different
Absolutely.
Outcomes.
Absolutely. I think everyone would agree. And the GP Leaders Forum gave you the 20-point plan, which would, I think, has got all the elements that you're looking
me
for.
Me too. Yeah, me too.
Equity, settlement of the Y2575 claim. One of the questions they raised was, the deadline for the end of the PHO contract having an impact on their ability to retain workforce in the next couple of years.
Totally.
What was the conversation like that you had with Sam Merton? Because you did respond pretty quickly to that letter.
Yeah, well, very positive, I think. I'm getting that. You'd have to ask whether they have a different view of that, of course, Barbara. But I feel like we've got a really constructive relationship, and that might be me deluding myself, but I come from general practice. I come from a primary care background. In my youth, I worked in general practices as a medical assistant in America. I've spent my whole career, over 30 years, I hate to admit how old I am, but I have, been in the primary care space and specifically general practice for a really long time in three different countries. And the issues are actually pretty similar, despite very different funding systems. They're actually pretty similar everywhere, which is a little bit disheartening because, you can't just fix these things through adopting a different method of funding. But the conversation was positive, and it was one, where I acknowledged that, that 20-point plan, Barbara, is actually very similar to all the stuff that we've been saying we need to work on together. Mm. And in that reimagining work, what I anticipate we will be doing and what we will be trying to solve. So that's no problem from my point of view. And I welcome that letter in that sense. I wouldn't have expected any other letter. I think for the general practice sector to just say, yes, thank you for what actually was the largest uplift that has been offered. And well, I went back in the data 13 years worth, and I know that it's the largest in at least that long and probably quite a bit longer. But to just accept that would imply that, that they think that's enough. And I understand why they therefore...
Well, especially when a government commissioned report, the Superior report, suggested that they were 14% underfunded, it's not surprising that they would have been unhappy with that offer.
Exactly. So I understand that. And as I explained and had talked about on a number of occasions with Sam and others, is that I literally offered the highest amount that we possibly could. I even tried to model it at 0.1 more of a percent, and we simply don't have that in the budget. Okay. So I am really happy to work with general practice, as I am with oral health care providers, as I am with aged care providers, to try to put forward the cases for what does the new world order look like? What does this society want? What can we afford? And put that forward to governments together to say, here's the package, here's the long-term blueprints. But again, we've got to do that in a way that you and I and all of the other taxpayers in this country can actually afford.
Do we have any time frame for achieving a new primary care funding model?
Well, I don't want to preempt what an outcome would be. We might stick very much with the same model, but tweak it around. We might need to, I'd say overhaul it fairly substantially, but I don't know that we'd be changing away from the capitation model necessarily. And that everything's on the table from my point of view, right? Yeah. I mean, as I say, I don't want to preempt what the outcome would be. And I've worked in enough systems under enough funding regimes to know that there isn't a silver bullet. There isn't a perfect one out there. And I actually think the one we have here with a bit of an overhaul is a pretty good one. Mm-hmm. But time frame. I absolutely, over this next 12 months, my work plan has, interestingly enough, about 20 points on it as well. And many of them mesh in with what was in that letter from our GP colleagues. But one of the big ticket items for me, and I've been calling it reimagining care, but some people don't like my language around that. But that work should be starting within the next few months. And I don't kid myself to think those are going to be short conversations, because there'll be different work streams to that, including things like workforce. And with that, we need to have education providers and others in the room to figure out what that training pipeline should be and to make sure that we are planning appropriately for the future. So I would say within 12 months, I hope to be getting some really solid recommendations in place, but I think some of these conversations will probably take a bit longer.
Yeah, because underpinning the whole Pai-ora legislation is the desire to achieve equity in health outcomes, and any kind of delay in funding reform is having a big impact on Māori providers
completely
and patients.
And even over the weekend, I've received a number of emails from my colleagues in that space and from IMPBs, and they are absolutely champing at the bit. And I get that. I understand. And I do feel bad that I don't feel like we can progress any more quickly than we are and get it right. Yeah, I definitely feel that pressure.
In terms of reimagining healthcare, and I actually think imagination plays a huge role in this.
Yeah.
I mean, we just recently saw the announcement of, you know, the minor ailments pilot in community pharmacy. We'd kind of like to understand how much wriggle room there actually is for funding of innovation in community health, new ways of delivering, while we are waiting for the primary care funding reform and localities to bed in.
So I can answer that pretty brutally to say there's not a lot of wriggle room. I would love to say that there's more wriggle room than there is, but certainly this year in terms of our budgets, there is an $8 billion budget for community and primary services. The vast majority of that, over $7 billion of that, is tied up in all of those contracts that we've offered a 5% uplift to. So it's not just general practice, but oral health and aged care, et cetera. And then the remainder of that is tied up in all of the budget 22 initiatives that were announced obviously over a year ago. And those are really fairly specific. So we have put aside a budget for the winter pressures initiatives, which is what Pharmacy One you mentioned earlier falls under. And we've put aside a budget for localities. So for me, the major drivers of innovation going forward, I say this a lot, Barbara, if I look at the old system where the decision points were about how funding got tied up, those decision points were things like, you know, obviously the minister, the ministry, DHBs, and PHOs to a certain extent have some flexibility in some of that decision-making locally. Those four need to make room for localities. And so some of that decision-making needs to decrease. In fact, a lot of that would be good to decrease so that we can create that space for localities to come to the fore and make some decisions. And so I really want us to reorient that innovation thinking to be driven by localities. But in addition to that, obviously with the reimagining work that I talked about earlier, I would expect that there will be some level of innovation that we can support through that. But apart from that, from a funding point of view, I've been breaking the very bad news to my team too, because they all like to, you know, innovate and come up with great new ideas. But just right now, we don't have the budget to support that.
I suppose given that the majority of the primary care sector, pharmacy, physio, general practice, midwives, are private businesses, if there's no more funding from government, then that means they absorb the missing funding.
Well, we have offered a 5% uplift across the board to all of those sectors. I come from that space myself, so I am absolutely sympathetic to providers who are saying we've had, you know, year after year, when I mentioned before ago, it's been at least 13 years, you know, that this is the largest increase in that amount of time. On the flip side of that argument, it's been 13 years or longer of much smaller increases. So I understand the impact that that has over time. My goal is we will be asking government to come to the party with more funding, but I also know that we have a constrained budget overall, and so we can't, again, make those sort of promises. We have to make sure that we are looking at other models of care, that we're looking at other workforces. And in localities, you know, one of the great things about the place-based planning initiatives is, you know, we call it the collective impact, right? So yes, we're standing up these, you know, these planning groups and we're funding, you know, initially them getting going, but the plans that they come up with, we've asked them to do well-being plans, and they've done exactly that, because community members, when they think about health and well-being, they don't just think about health services. So in many of these localities, the top priority is housing, or, you know, things that are, you know, about jobs and education. And they're in that social determinant space, which is exactly what we actually want, and where we keep our rhetoric is always about that's where we need to put our investment. But we never do that, do we? Okay. In this case, we have the ability with these plans. In fact, I'm presenting just after this, Barbara, I'm presenting to the Social Wellbeing Board about localities. And I know Margie and others have presented them previously, and they're very interested in the localities approach. And if we can get all of those agencies coming to the table, so putting health dollars toward the health things, putting housing dollars toward housing issues, local government's coming to the table with their investment and resources as well. And I want to get corporate New Zealand in there too. You know, we will have a ready-made menu of things that local communities have said they really want and care about and that would make the difference locally. If we can get all of that investment, all of us, you know, paddling the waka in the same direction, that for me is kind of where we might start to really be able to make a difference and stop relying entirely on thinking that a government is going to be able to solve this with more and more money, which we just know we don't have.
How do we get Wayne Brown interested in what's happening at Te Whatu'ora? You know, I see local government as having a huge role in the health and well-being of populations, but kind of tied up in their own worlds. Maybe in smaller communities, you can have some success because they are smaller communities. But in Auckland, I mean, we've got a history of, you know, like the three DHBs, even just bringing them together, let alone dragging in the super city council. I mean, how do we even start with that?
Look, I actually am pretty happy about starting with smaller communities because that's where a lot of our health inequities are. And we've got a lot of local councils who are absolutely on board. I just met last week, I think it was, the minister had a meeting with Local Government New Zealand with their CEO and others. And I was involved with that meeting. And there's a great amount of enthusiasm for supporting the localities approach. When we get into larger cities is where I think localities is a little bit more challenging because you don't have the natural boundaries that you have in a smaller or more rural community, and people don't know each other as well. They don't automatically know their neighbors, and they don't, you know the problems that people are facing in the same way, except for obviously we've got communities within communities, and you know, we are looking at localities in that way too. But it's a challenge, I think, in some of the larger areas to figure out how are we going to get them interested.
Because we wouldn't want to see them thinking that getting involved with their responsibilities for health and well-being means taking a slice of vote health.
No, absolutely. That's right. No.
We've got to hold on to that.
We're seeing it the other way around, that it's about us all, you know, tipping into the local bucket. You know, if it's cycling paths that people will use and want, again, I'm really happy for us to be investing in that preventative end of care. Mm. Obviously, there are rules about what health dollars can go toward. But if we can, you know, if we can address those bits and get others addressing their bits, all according to what communities have said that they want, then that's the goal of this.
Mm-hmm. This morning's Herald headlines with call for an end to postcode lottery in health. I mean, postcode lottery is a really popular political tagline. It seems to me that this is a term that really dogs the sector. How do you deliver the message that it's not about the actual way services in any area are delivered? It's more about ensuring equitable outcomes irrespective of how the services are delivered. Just because your services are being delivered by a podiatrist or a nurse practitioner doesn't mean to say it's any lesser than if it's being delivered by a pharmacist or a general practitioner.
Yeah, I think we have to get better at measuring what matters and promoting that. And that's, you know, two things. One is outcomes. So showing what those outcomes are, irrespective of who has delivered that care, as you've said. And the second is, and localities' plans give us the first real ability to do this, measuring what matters to people. You know, right now, we can't measure what matters to people because we haven't asked them. We don't know. But in a locality plan, we do know. We have a very clear list. And some of those localities, Taikorahi is a good example. The other thing that impressed me with that plan is it was concise, which is very unusual in my world. I'm used to documents that have a lot of words and say very little. But it was concise and it was aspirational, but it was practical and pragmatic. And they had 1 year, you know, measurements. They had, if I recall correctly, you know, all the way up to 20-year measures in this plan. And so if we start measuring our success based on what people have said that they want and showing that the outcomes are actually what matters and showing what those outcomes are, I think we won't get away from people still, you know, using political terms and trying to, you know, do what they do. But at least we will have answers that I think would resonate with most people.
Mm. One area that in the last 20 years has been quite successful with regard to integrating primary and secondary care has been Canterbury. And I heard over the weekend that there's been a decision to wind up the Canterbury Clinical Network by next June. And I can understand that Te Whatu'ora is kind of moving towards a common structure throughout the country. The Canterbury Clinical Network gave rise to the Health Pathways, which is an initiative which is often referenced by Te Whatu'ora. And I just wonder, with some of those kind of initiatives and local programs, isn't there an advantage in keeping them running while the rest of the country kind of catches up with some of the work that's being done in that integrated space?
You're absolutely right. In my team, we're actually increasing the number of clinical roles. It's one of the things that I'm quite proud of with the commissioning team and where we're going. in amongst the top team, the clinical director of primary and community care, who also has a dotted reporting line back into the overall clinical leadership of Te Whatu Ora, which is, you know, we haven't really had that before. We've also got an increased number of clinical roles, whether advisory roles or clinical directors and clinical integrators. And the pathways work, whilst it's moving to a different part of Te Whatu Ora, it's still going to be there. I'm a huge supporter of pathways. I'm familiar with pathways from my work in Australia as well. And I know that even just the process of developing the pathway is actually one of the most valuable ways and practical ways of figuring out what the real gaps in the healthcare system actually are. And therefore, you know, once you know what the gaps are, you at least have a bit of a direction of how to fill those. So I think a lot of what we're encountering at the moment is when we come out and say, look, we're going to stop doing this because we're now going to call it this. And part of that now calling it this is trying to change our culture away from thinking of ourselves as 20 separate, fully self-contained operating units. And changing that culture involves trying to take that really good stuff and actually spread it everywhere, magnify the really good stuff so that it's not just happening in one place. And it's not just contributing to that postcode lottery. Okay. But the point that we're at in that process makes it feel like we're actually disassembling really important things, when in fact, what we're trying to do is take them and magnify them and amplify them and make them more nationally relevant, as opposed to leaving it in a, you know, one geographic region.
Yeah. I've always found it a little bit ironic with health pathways, in that there's perceived to be an antagonism within central health agencies towards private providers. And of course, health pathways is a large private provider, as is Whakaronga Aotearoa, two key players in our sector, which are private. It's just an observation from me. Andrew Little said he was agnostic about business models in primary care. I kind of thought, oh, well, that's fine. You know, he's pragmatic. But I realised there's actually a real need for some kind of policy development around where we're going. We're kind of leaving everything to happen. You know, the corporates or the networks are growing, or is that good? Is that bad? Do we want young doctors to be able to buy in? Do we want them to work salary? Do we want, and ultimately, as a country, we can't afford to nationalize primary care. I mean, we can't
leave this to market forces, and we have.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess, part of the point of the reimagining work for me is about deliberately designing the system. And I don't see enough evidence that that has been the approach. We've, you know, deliberately done little bits and pieces, but not whole of system, long range plan. Let's think through the consequences of allowing overseas investors to come in and buy things up. Let's think through the consequences of, you know, where do we get if we keep funding individual private organizations to take on, you know, bigger and bigger pieces of the service delivery. You know, let's think through all those consequences. I'm not judging whether what the right answer is yet, but we need to present ourselves and our communities with that kind of evidence so that we can make informed decisions.
So we're getting to the crunch with regard to politics, because next month we'll see the start of the classic pre-election government shutdown around about the 15th of July, when we get really no major decisions in the lead up to election. Do you get any sense that this will have an impact on your work program at all?
I don't think so. This will be my first time living through this in this country. I've certainly been through it a few times.
It's pretty quiet, believe me.
That would be nice. Somehow I kind of doubt it, actually, in the background. But no, I don't actually think it will. You know, we've, as a Crown agency, you know, can carry on with our work and continue making the decisions that we make. So I don't expect that it's going to have any negative impact on how we're performing.
Abby, we're coming to the end of our conversation. Is there anything else you'd like to comment on or add?
Look, I think, you know, for me, my personal objectives for what I'm trying to achieve here, and if you know, there's a lot, actually, it's probably a pretty long list if I thought about it, but things like, you know, embedding localities as an enduring feature of New Zealand's health sector, you know, for the purposes of supporting Tinaranga Tiratanga, for achieving community and whānau-led commissioning, and for enabling us to measure, as we talked a bit before, you know, system performance based on what matters to people. That's got to be, for me, one of my absolute key objectives, as well as, and I referenced this earlier, establishing strong primary and community clinical leadership in the commissioning team and influencing our hospital and specialist colleagues, as well as the funded sector, to behave and work together as one unified system. In this country, I think we've got the best chance of achieving that of just about anywhere that I can think of. And for me, it's also about, you know, an objective is simplifying the health system, you know, removing fragmentation. And again, I feel like we've got more of a chance of doing that here than any place else I've ever worked. And I'm starting that by, you know, removing some of the drivers of fragmentation that stem from our own team structure. You know, we'll no longer be putting up lots of budget bids and having ever-growing teams to implement those programs and projects. You know, we want to move out of the way and create space for localities to determine our priorities and, you know, listen to sector experts and people with lived experience and diverse voices to design our longer term plans. And last but not least, it's for me, you know, my priority is about honoring the basis of these reforms, which is in recognizing and acting on Te Tiriti commitments. I've, you know, talked about Te Kōrahi, and I genuinely feel this. You know, it's a passion of mine, and I'm so pleased to be here and to be involved. And I've appreciated the lovely, warm welcome. And I also welcome the challenging conversations, because it's, I think, in those conversations where we really make the most progress.
I think it's fair to say that there are a few people who work in the health sector who don't do it without some passion for what they do. And I'm always very aware when I get to the end of some of these conversations that we're very seldom mentioned the word patient, but you know, at the heart of it is the patient journey. I can tell you in our office at the Health Media, we have a portrait of a patient, which was taken by GP Chris Reed up north, and he's in the middle of our room. Yeah. So thank you so much for joining me today, and best of luck, because I know it is not an easy task you've undertaken. And amongst all the controversy, we do appreciate that someone has to do this work.
So well, thank it's you. My pleasure. Kia ora, and thank you.
Na mihi nui. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to me, Barbara Fountain, chatting with Te Whatu Ora National Director Commissioning, Abby Anderson. Apologies to Abby for talking over her sign-off there, a slight technical hitch with the audio channels. Thanks for listening to System Fix, brought to you by the Health Media. We're passionate about transparency and accountability in the health system and providing great news and education to clinicians in primary care and beyond. If you would like to learn more about the health reforms, check out Reform Shorts in our publication, New Zealand Doctor Rate Aotearoa. Go to nzdoctor.co.nz to subscribe to our fortnightly print publication, our daily email newsletter, Daily Triage, and to over 20 years of online news archives. Likewise, if you are interested in issues in the pharmacy sector, go to pharmacytoday.co.nz. Both publications offer hassle-free, password-free group subscriptions. Thanks to Steve Hart for post-production work on System Fix, and to all you folks out there listening. Until next time, Nga mihi nui!